let me just start by talking about why we're having this panel and what our rationale was in having it. So it seems like we're at this very interesting point all of a sudden in hardware where we've had 15 years of commodity, where everybody was racing as quickly as they could to buy high-volume parts, whether they're GPUs or, you know, Intel CPUs or Ethernet networks or whatever. And suddenly there's a lot of interesting things that are starting to happen where we're getting purpose-built hardware again. Right, so you see stuff like ARM, you see stuff like the Open Compute Platform coming up. You know, you've got disaggregated hardware, and of course you've had this sort of steady trend of HPC dogfooding every random thing that vendors come up with over the last 30 years. Right, some for better, some for worse, and so it feels like we're on the cusp of these major changes to data center architecture, to system architecture, to the kinds of machines that we can reasonably build.
It's all that Maker Faire stuff.
What?
It's all that Maker Faire stuff.
That's right. It's going to be all Arduinos in the future.
Exactly.
So the reason that we're having this panel really is to get people thinking about how systems change, right, and how systems are going to be changing. So an obvious example from the last 5 years is that IOPS are a hell of a lot cheaper than they used to be.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it used to be that you needed to just put rows of disks if you wanted large counts of IOPS.
Well, it was getting scary, right? The number of bytes per rack were going like this, and the number of IOPS were this. Mm-hmm. And people were saying, but I've just bought like petabytes of disk. What do you mean I can't access it all at the same time? And now you can.
Right. And so it only seems reasonable with the amount of engineering work that's going in. What are the big changes that you guys see coming in the next 5 years? What are the changes out of HPC that are going to make it to the wider world? What are the trends that you think are going to come out of you know, both changes to sort of system architecture and component availability, manageability, disaggregation, right? So I'm just sort of casting a wide net. What do you think is interesting?
I think one of the places in HPC that we're going to see some pretty significant changes is in the memory space.
Yeah.
We've kind of hit a lot of walls recently, and those walls were projected that they were going to be hit for a long time. And I think we all sort of got into this mode of thinking, well, you know, they told me that I wasn't going to have any memory, no bandwidth, and no disk, but everything keeps growing. But now things actually aren't. And so with this generation machine, we've got a memory problem, and with the next generation machine, it's going to be worse. But there are some new technologies that are coming, the 3D stacked memory and all of this other stuff that they're doing, that looks like it actually is going to pay off in about the 17, 18 time frame. And I actually have seen some things that give indication that that's going to maybe hit the open market at around the same time. So we may be bringing them all to both spaces, both the HPC space and the more commodity space, in a similar time frame.
Well, and I think for a lot of us that are doing things in larger scale, whatever, we've been benefiting quite a bit from everybody buying iPhones and these types of things. I mean, there's been an explosion in like exceptionally high powered consumer devices. And when you think about what you get in a top of the line phone today compared to 15 years ago, what you had as a server,
the GPU you get in a phone that's probably adding $6-7 to the price of the phone is the equivalent of $1,000 for the compute 5 years ago.
Yeah, and
basically a supercomputer in your phone these days. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now there are, you know, so when you start thinking around some of those changes in consumers, those changes are absolutely in like high speed memory systems, and actually around graphical processing and everything else. So.
I was laughing at the question you gave an answer earlier on about this disaggregated machine that you'll build with 1,000 CPUs and terabytes of RAM. And I was thinking, well, the solution to that would be DRAM is probably going to be phased out in data centers in the next 4 or 5 years, and we'll see things like NVRAM. And NVRAM is going to be hilarious because I have no idea how to use this. How do you use a memory that doesn't go away when you reboot? So suddenly your machine breaks and you go, well, we'll try reboot first.
You use it as an exceptionally fast write-through cache. That's how you use it.
That's one thing, but imagine then you have this.
But is that 40... it? I mean, like that's a sort of obvious step in the storage hierarchy that you can add in non-volatile storage, but like, is that the right way to use?
No, I mean, the fact that you're going to get decent-sized non-volatile RAM that's in a DIMM form factor is pretty nice. I mean,
but you'll never reboot again, because if you reboot, boom, it comes back the same way it was.
Yeah.
So we no longer reboot, we reinstall. So we better not screw up system images in a way that need a reboot.
So I think one of the things that's going to have to happen with this memory hierarchy, because I think on the HPC side, we're going to have some pretty significant memory hierarchy. We're going to have that super high speed memory right next to the chip on package with it. We're going to have the DRAM kind of speeds and capacities. We're going to have the MVRAM. We're going to have the burst buffer maybe even between that. We're going to have the I/O storage. And all of a sudden, our programs are going to have the ability to take care of managing memory locality and placement and wiping out the memory as you need. And I think the software is going to be key. And I think that's my fear, is the software is not going to be there. The hardware is going to be very cool in this time frame. I don't know if anybody ever be able to actually affect
it. I tend to be a, what's the word for someone who cares about operating systems? But I tend to.
Archaic?
That's or cutting edge, depending on the year.
Yeah, both.
But when you start thinking about everything that's happening as far as, because you look like the optical chips we're using. I mean, those are CMOS, so they're hybrid optical and electrical, on a chip. And you're talking about those going. I mean, those right now, to understand, those are 13, 10 nanometer chips. So, those getting down to, the 90, 60 sort of range, and then getting larger from there. Then you got literally onboard programmable FPGAs in the chips. You got all sorts of other stuff that's happening like that. Or even just this idea that you're deciding that you're actually doing a very large pool of RAM where some of it is local through those types of connections. Some of it is, 10 meters away over optical and so on like that. What operating system do you even run on that? So we're going to get, I think, pretty quickly back to low-level system programming rather fast. And
that's always hard. Like, I remember the first NUMA systems coming across the first NUMA systems, and the kernel programmers were like, "Oh, we'll try and pin the jobs to this four CPUs, and we'll try and pin this one over here."
Yeah.
And oh, they have to keep the memory look. Oh, screw it. We'll just stripe it over all memory. It's going to always be mediocre, but at least it will be consistent.
And exactly. I mean,
the real answer to how you what OS you run on one of these weird aggregation machines, it's Irix.
Yeah,
right. Talk about sad, right? But I mean, that's kind of what it was, right?
I was a big Irix user.
I think a lot of this stuff is really happening today already as well. Like, I mean, I think the silicon photonics stuff is super interesting, for example, because it will really enable things that currently isn't possible. But we're already, to a large degree, actually being able to do things like that by having 40 gigs, down to the individual server. That actually allows us to no longer be bound to the individual server with things anymore. And it kind of still bounds us within the rack to some degree, but I guess that's the next big step that we can, to your point, get outside of that and not just be meters away, hundreds of meters away.
Yeah, but that's because, you look at, I used to be in the HPC space at sort of one point, and you look at that, you're still, 40 gig to server doesn't fix the imbalance that you still have 360 gig between CPU and memory on a local board. Mm-hmm. Mm. But now when all of a sudden you say have 400, 800, 1.2 terabit per second between systems within a rack, and now you're basically sitting there at two times or three times faster than local memory I/O. Well, then what do you do?
Well, so it's interesting, actually, before I guess retired from the HPC space, the last paper I worked on, we were doing this benchmarking, and there was a system, the mirror system that Susan was talking about earlier today, that has more bandwidth in aggregate to other nodes' memory than it has to its own memory because the network is so fast, right? And so we're starting to see these weird tipping points where the system, all these rules of thumb that you have for things being slower or faster are kind of getting thrown out the window.
Yeah, but I don't know about that because I think Mira was sort of the end of that particular kind, right?
Yeah.
That was has sort of, to some extent, been deemed too expensive to continue with that in the same way that it was deemed too expensive to go forward with the capacity we needed in the memory space because you could buy that much DRAM, but you couldn't afford to do it, right? And then the network is what is biting the dust, I think, in the next generations because we're no longer going to have our fabulous 5D Taurus that is insanely low latency, insanely fast, and insanely scalable. we're going to be going back down, I believe, backwards. So we'll see if we realize any of that.
So it's interesting because the step backwards that you're talking about is a step that's still a step forward from what Joel was talking about, but it's a largely comparable topology, right? I mean, it's going to be, you know, some sort of fat tree looking thing, maybe, you know, hypercube of fat trees or whatever, but with high link speeds. And it's sort of interesting to think about which aspects of the network are going to make it out to the commodity space, because the tolerance that supercomputing has for complexity and failures are pretty high compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
So an optical is interesting in that depending on your vendor, you can get really, really high failure rates, right? So on the silicon photonics that you guys are using, is that something we can ship to, I don't know, $200 a port anytime soon?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, and it's single mode as well. So, I mean, you're basically, I mean, with single mode optical, you're essentially at the, you know, you can get down to the same latencies and everything else you have on copper. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, because when you're dealing with that, it makes a lot of the not maybe the low level system software is going to be a pain in the ass, but once you get out of that, it's going to make applications an awful lot simpler.
Yeah, like, the cool thing is the stuff's made out of sand, so the other stuff's made out of things that coins are made out of.
Yeah, we can throw out a big cable and go back to Berkeley DB again.
Absolutely, if only Oracle didn't own it.
So one thing that Jason mentioned...
Level DB.
Triggered a thought. So there seems to be this trend towards aggregation on package that's really picking up a lot of steam. So you mentioned FPGAs on die.
Yeah.
You know, Intel's finally got... CPU parts with a NIC on package now.
Yeah,
I think it's actually on die. You're starting to see, you know, all sorts of interesting stuff. There's probably going to be, you know, other components and VRAM, you know, whatever else you can think of that's going to get integrated on package.
There's a lot of cool system on chips being built.
Right. But there's also companies you can go to and you say, can I have a 64 core ARM chip and four of those type of NICs, please?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they'll go, it'll cost you, but we can do it.
Yeah.
So when's the first, like, custom silicon for open compute?
Yeah, I mean, silicon photonics is something that's, I think, Intel has already actually contributed part of to open compute as well. So it's something that I think is hugely interesting in that space for sure. And, I mean, just in general, the whole ability to completely disaggregate things. That, I mean, that's really what open compute is all about. So, I mean, what Jason talked about is really, like, key building blocks that would enable us to go even further with what we've done there.
And then someone just needs to fix the holy grail of packet switching on optical, then we're fine.
Right.
Talk to the butt.
I think they have to turn it on up there.
Okay, I think it's on.
Okay, great, thanks. So when it comes to hardware, there are certain variants that you can't really go around, stuff like physics. Speed of light is not going to change, so maybe you can play with bandwidth, but as far as latency goes, we're pretty down to, you know, the minimum. And there are other invariants, of course, in every direction you go. So, like, 10 years ago, we were pretty far from those, and we had a lot to optimize.
Mm-hmm.
But now it seems we've got down to, you know, a lot of those invariants. So what next? Are we going to develop a whole new... different kind of technology? Are we going to just scale out our chips, you know, add more CPUs and so on? And what is this going to do to software?
So one of my favorite ones is a friend of mine who's big into wireless networking, and he's looking at a lot of the research papers on optical now. And the Shannon limit basically says on single frequency that you can go up to about 200 gigabits, and then you're kind of boned. There's no more. 100 gigabit Ethernet, there's probably not going to be terabit Ethernet, right? Yeah, without magic. But the wireless guys have already fixed this. They're doing crazy stuff with polarization. They've a bunch of stuff using non-overlapping frequencies and stuff like that. So I think we can probably keep going on bandwidth. But when you start doing that, your latency will start to increase again. So there's going to end up being a bandwidth latency trade-off, I suspect.
And throughput changes as well.
Well, the other thing is that while latencies have come down an awful lot, you need to do an awful lot of software bypass to get rid of latency. So if you think about like a standard transmission path for a packet through a TCP stack, almost all of the latency is in the software, not the hardware.
Yeah, and by the
way, even if it's going far, right? You know, a lot of and it's gotten a lot better, but within a single data center, most commodity networks are still spending a lot of time on the software processing part of it.
So an example of the problem is that you send a packet, it goes back to the network, comes back in 1.1 milliseconds, and then it spends 10 milliseconds waiting in the scheduler for the thread that handles this packet to be scheduled. So the whole thing of latencies is now, you know, in your software. It's not the hardware anymore.
Right. Well, I mean, inside of a single data center, you're sort of three orders of magnitude off, right?
Yeah.
Because your ping pong latency should be something like 3 to 5 microseconds is like really cutting down to the bone, right? And so the moment that you're talking about milliseconds for ping pong latencies, there's a lot of improvement left to do, and even going a kilometer over fiber is not going to substantially change that equation, right? So I think there's still a lot of room for improvement in commodity circumstances. There are places where you know, you're using RDMA and hardware offload that this is already pared down pretty substantially, but there's a lot of room for most of the world to improve.
Well, one of the interesting things on a lot of commodity chips now support RDMA. So we're getting to the place now where, you know, a 50 quid NIC probably supports RDMA over converged Ethernet. Software might not, but hardware is there.
Software is the easy part.
No, but I think it's, I mean, I think the point's sort of a given. I mean, we can still squeeze through. I mean, if you really look at the latency on some of these networks, it's in the, you know, the tens of nanoseconds, and being able to squeeze another log or so out of that is doable. But yes, it doesn't make software faster. So
I think disks have hit a wall with physics. Like disks were kind of done.
Yeah, but I think maybe there's some new tech that may be coming, not even just a 3D stack stuff, but I think there's some new tech that may be coming to breathe some life in. I think for us on the HPC side, what we hit that disk stuff a while back. And you can look at the progression of these machines, and you'll see the compute power increasing, the memory increasing, memory bandwidth, latency, you know, all doing the right stuff. But disk, it hit it 10 years ago, and we haven't seen the improvements there at all. But I have heard rumors.
They still have a little arm moving around.
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's killing us. However, I will point out that if you look at the history of HPC over time, what happens is there's hardware improvements, and you hit a pain point, and they start trying to recover that pain point in software. But then somebody comes up with a great innovation on the hardware space, and everybody dumps the software and goes off to the hardware because it's so much easier to fix things there than it is to fix things in the software stack. There's a lot of room in the software stack, like Narayan was saying, for improvements. My question is whether we're actually going to do it or whether we're going to get some cool innovations that are going to come and save us from having to dive into the software space again. Because I think there was some comment this morning about how all software sucks. I agree with that pretty much wholeheartedly.
Hello.
Oh, no, put it down. It. You just...
Just hold it.
Just hug it.
You don't have to put your mouth on it.
So we heard a lot about innovations, but not a huge amount about reliability. And I'm wondering that Susan in her talk talked about having a lot of compute capacity in one location. And I think Jason talked about maybe having like 288 petabytes of storage in one location, which is really fantastic for that one location, but when it goes on fire, is probably going to suck as you try to desperately move stuff elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what the panel think about the sweet spot for how many data center locations you have, how much capacity you have in each of those locations, and how that changes depending on the innovations that you've talked about.
I think it's a complicated modeling problem that depends entirely on your workload.
Yeah.
Right? And so like there's almost no way to answer the question unless you talk about a very specific use case, because there's some applications that don't benefit at all from distribution. There's some, or there, you know, for example, the workloads that Susan's running on her machine, distribution is a net loser. It means you just can't run the workloads at all. Whereas for other workloads, centralization is a complete killer, and it kills your performance, right? If you're building a CDN and you're putting all of your data in one place, you're probably going to be sad, right? And all the applications are in this spectrum, and I think that one of the things that...
We have some stuff we're trying to put in a million locations, because you start looking at some of the sort of data collection type use cases on it. There's not enough middle mile capacity to bring all up in the centralized data centers. So we're trying to do more filtering and quantization and other things sort of like at the edge. Then we just start getting into fun associative models around all that stuff. But totally depends. You have big math problems. Calculator problems.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that in our space, if you do what I would call cost-benefit analysis and you consider resiliency and redundancy versus the performance cost that you pay with resiliency and redundancy, HPC in my space, we're always going for the performance because we're always pushing the boundary. Our machine is a $200 million machine. We're not going to get to have multiple versions of that sitting around. We could spend less money on one machine and then do smaller problem sets, but our goal is all about solving the problems that can't be solved today on distributed systems or otherwise. I think everybody has some place in that spectrum they fall to where the cost of resiliency and redundancy pays off in some way, shape, or form for them or not. And we happen to fall on the, we're never gonna do the resiliency, redundancy.
Yeah.
We can barely afford to, you know, put two basket filters on our cooling system. That's what we just kind of cringe and say, yeah, we got to have that because if the cooling goes down, the machine's down, and it's a reasonable cost. But,
yeah, but
other people,
yep.
I guess we would be on the other end of the spectrum
exactly.
In many ways. Like we don't really care about a single machine, a single row, a single data suite, a single data center even. Like we published data information last year where we actually DR'd an entire data center region and just killed it to see what happens, and it just fails over and redistributes the workload without a single person outside of Facebook knowing about it or noticing. But I mean, that's given our workload. And I think like for use cases like us, disaggregation is not really going to mean massive machines with like enormous amounts of storage or memory or CPU per machine, because that just makes that one machine a lot more sensitive. Like you lose that one, you lose such a big chunk of capacity. So we're almost heading in the separate direction with like smaller and smaller, simpler and simpler machines. And then just trying to aggregate things like storage and so on outside of the machine and not have it like centralized per machine in that case.
And for even one workload, it's not necessarily a static thing. So you might say, great, 3,000 machines per data center, that worked for us 10 years ago. And then we built bigger switches, and it's like, oh, we can actually put 30,000 machines together and run bigger workloads and have better things running together. And then, of course, at some point, someone's go, can we do 300,000? It's like, yeah, but maybe we shouldn't. And then, I don't know, you suddenly realize you could design data centers maybe with cheaper power that's less reliable, and suddenly you could do what we did with 30,000. Maybe we should dial it back to 10, because now we can run them cheaper, and we'll take the hit on occasionally not being able to build a big workspace. So as technology changes and the real world changes and energy prices change, you can end up changing your aggregation sizes as well.
Yeah, and I think the key on this is, I mean, in general, you want to build something that's highly available, right? So that's usually the idea. And when you start thinking of a couple sort of angles on this, I mean, on one hand, you can build something highly available with completely unreliable parts and go for much more of a resiliency model and so on. In other cases, something actually does have to be bulletproof and survive a forest fire and things like that. So, you know, you are now building a system that needs to have a certain, you know, other sort of environmental factors play. And when you get to that point, it's always more expensive. Like a bulletproof car is more expensive than a normal car. So building something that can survive a forest fire is going to be more expensive than building something that isn't. And I think there's another sort of angle to this that became very, very clear to us when we started thinking about like the disaggregated systems. And that was when you start taking like a completely component-based view of everything while trying to minimize the number of components, make those components very easy to swap out, make them very easy to sort of interchange, you know, then what you're able to do is you can start thinking about something that might be present for 10, 15, you know, 20, 25, 30 years, that unless the actual DIMM slot itself changes or what a plug looks changes or so on like that, you start thinking around those physical sort of life cycles of, like, you know, how often that sort of interface changes or not. Then you can start thinking of systems that you can, like, continuously improve. You know, if you're able to basically just swap out motherboards and leave everything else in place, great. You know, if you're able to basically, like, you know, take something that normally was a very network intensive, you know, and then incrementally add components to it to completely change what that point of presence is doing, you know, then getting down to technologies that allow us to basically not scale at the, you know, the data center or the rack or the system level, but basically just have an ever different mix of components on the same common connectivity that goes into some same common mechanics, you know, then you can start getting to that sweet spot where you can make incremental investments and completely change what you're doing with that site.
Do we have any connectors that might stay stable for a decade? Or G45 is pretty badass.
Like, yeah, it's
you know,
it's,
everything else seems to be changing quite often. Like,
yeah, but you know, then it's just a it just takes a sleeve, you know. I mean, we didn't think we were going to go to single mode optical so fast, and we still have a bunch of multi mode optical and the radio stuff, and so we built a little sleeve that goes on multi mode, and it's got a little thing inside of it, and you put the single mode in there, and you're like, ta-da! You know, so you have to build adapters sometimes. I mean, you know, but you know, we have things like, you know, the world's, you know, electrical system is sort of an example of, despite the fact plugs are everywhere, we seem to figure something out. So, the worst case scenario, you got some little modulator in between two other things or something. But
so what does all this stuff mean for manageability? Right? So it sounds like everything that's been predicted has been more complexity, more complication in software, in system design, in sort of specialization and variability.
I think we can get to the point. I mean, look at whether it be the open compute design or like what you guys have been doing inside of Google and what we're trying to do and everything else. I mean, the fact is, when you do minimize the number of moving parts and you do minimize the number of components, then you are able to make, like, system management software that's a lot easier. You know, the task at hand, I think, just becomes, those of us that have been working down at this sort of level, we've been like making hardware and saying, here's your hardware, here's your BIOS, go do whatever. But you know, if you start getting to the point where it's like, now here's a platform for your applications or your platform for your system of record, and everyone starts taking much more of sort of a, I'm dealing with a, you know, atomic, immutable little either image or container or something else sort of like that. We need to find like the right interface, I think, between people that manage data and people that write applications. And it probably means that most of us that are doing low-level things need to go up stack and just start having much more of a sort of platform view of that. So I think we do potentially have the ability where we can take a lot of the complexity out by taking more of that. But then you do take some choices away from people, like, you don't get to choose what your operating system environment is, and you don't get to choose this, and you don't get to choose this, and you don't get to choose this. You need to write your apps into this type of thing without going as far as some of these other platforms have gone where they're too limiting. I mean, there's some sweet spot in between there that we just haven't quite found yet.
Okay. So do we have time for one last question? Hands up, anyone? There's one over there, if you could check it over.
Oh, yeah, that's a good
one. Oh, that's an arm.
About the optical stuff, photonics, do you think it's useful to have fiber optic cables which are air-filled instead of glass, instead of fiber, because they have 30% round-trip time improvement?
Well, round-trip time improvement sounds great.
Okay, sorry, only for the signal.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense for data centers. It really doesn't.
I mean,
so one of the problems with the airfill stuff, I think it is a much lower bend radius.
Yeah.
So maybe for long haul, like really long haul.
I mean, anything's possibly awesome. But I'm just trying to think.
Yeah. As far as I know, the real problems are in bend radius.
Yeah,
you can
exactly.
End up getting deformations there.
Well, thank you very much. And John, Joel, Susan, Jason, and Narayan.
Thank you.
Thank you.